Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 22nd, 2018. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the educator and author, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Very well, very well. So, Mariah, there is outrage in the air this midsummer time. At least I'm outraged on a variety of crazy levels. So let me just lead you through the, it's either stochastic or neurotic. I can't figure out what connection I see in these kind of articles, but just stay with me. Last Sunday in the Boston Globe, I think it was Sunday, in the Boston Globe, there was what I regard as a fairly deceptive op-ed piece on the editorial page by the editors of the Boston Globe. With a title, I'll put up the link to it. Basically, the current title says Massachusetts residents pay the highest average retail price for power in the continental United States, which to the uninitiated or the person who's not really paying attention would translate to make you think that citizens of Massachusetts pay the highest bills, the highest electricity bills in the country. And of course, the whole gist of this op-ed piece was to plump for the construction of new natural gas pipelines because of all the terrible things that would happen if we don't have more natural gas pipelines. And I don't know if you've been paying attention, but there are various kind of scare campaigns talking about being freezing in the dark in 10 years because we don't have enough pipelines, all kind of stuff like that. I guess the reason that I was upset about it, not the only one, was that it was deliberately deceptive in its titling. And the reason is the following, that Massachusetts does have a relatively high rate of dollars per kilowatt hour. Right? We're not the highest in the country, at least depending on how you rank things, but we're fairly high. Massachusetts has a fairly high rate. On the other hand, the average consumption of electricity in Massachusetts is quite low, or much lower, so that it turns out our average electrical bill in aggregate, the bill you pay, the check that you write, is about average for the entire country, you know, compared to all the other places. And that's because we may have high rates, but we have low usage because of all the good efficiency efforts that have been made here in Massachusetts. So fine. The other thing that's troubling and leads me to my, you know, to the next point is that somehow I don't understand why the Boston Globe seems to be accepting hook, line, and sinker the talking points of the natural gas industry. I mean, this is probably the fourth or fifth editorial put up by the Globe that basically could have been written in a public relations shop, and in fact, probably was. There's this kind of undercover natural gas pipeline group here. I think it's called a very innocuous name, you know, like Energy for Massachusetts or something, that is pushing pipelines. It's just distressing that the Globe has accepted this kind of copy from the industry and is publishing it as an editorial. So hang that on the wall.
They did not mention anything about the efficiency in the article. Did they? How we compare average.
They talk a lot about demand. You know, skyrocketing prices on cold days in January.
Right? Wow.
So, I guess what I see is some sort of, I mean, I don't have my aluminum foil hat on, but I mean, there's some sort of dark conspiracy there at the Globe. But that leads me to an article by Eric Holthaus, who writes for Grist. And if you Eric Holthaus lives in the Boston area, I think. But he was making the case that this debacle in Helsinki, right? Somebody called it the stinky in Helsinki between President Putin and our sorry excuse was in many ways about natural gas and fossil fuel. That between the United States and Russia, they control a significant fraction of the world's oil supply, and that maintaining that value over the long term is important to both of those leaders. And so you see all of the the stuff that Trump has done to pull out of the Paris Accord, all this stuff that his new henchman at the EPA, Mr. Andy Wheeler, is doing, you can read the close relationship between Trump and Putin as based in fossil fuel, kind of a fossil fuel oligarchy from two petrostates. I don't think it's too strong a word to say that now. And, of course, there is that sort of dark rumor that Putin tried to sell Trump 35% of Rosneft, which was some national oil company over there in Russia. But put that aside. That's a lunatic fringe too far. So then the Putin-Trump thing makes me think of his insane tariff. You know, we've gone to war with Canada because they're threatening our national security by selling us aluminum or something. I saw this interesting idea that said other countries could have a double whammy, right? So what's going to happen with in tariffs? In a tariff thing, the United States puts a tax on incoming material from another country. So when Canada tries to send us steel, the United States will put a tariff on that steel, forcing the price of that steel up. So now the steel inside the United States is more expensive. The risk of a trade war is that, that, for example, Canada could decide to put a tariff on some other good that's leaving the United States and going into Canada, right? The reverse, right? They put a tariff on something we want to sell them, makes our goods more expensive over there. So this cool idea, which I would support if we're going to have a trade war, is that other countries should put tariffs on American goods that are based on their carbon content, essentially a carbon tax on things leaving the United States. So that would mean, you know, if you want to export coal to China, then there would be a tariff imposed by the Chinese on that to achieve the Chinese goals of reduced emissions. And it's a way to sort of use the carbon, I'm sorry, use the fighting global warming and fighting the Trump tariff war at the same time. I just thought it was intriguing.
Yeah, so I think that brings up so many interesting questions and lines of thought. I mean, the first thing I'm wondering is, I assume that in the past, people have been hesitant to talk about that because it sort of starts to unravel the delicate balance of trade in some ways, right?
A trade war or just the carbon thing?
If other countries were to start putting a carbon tax on what we're sending out, then we're going to retaliate, right, by, you know, taxing the stuff they're sending in, right? It becomes sort of this back and forth kind of thing. But Trump has pretty much already, he's done that, right? I mean,
he's already started
pushed that
it, yeah.
domino over, right? I mean, to some degree. So, maybe that has, have you heard, do you think this is an argument that's gathering steam?
There's lots of, you hear lots of clever arguments and things that you can do. Whether or not this would have any significant traction, I don't know. But I think it depends.
It wouldn't be good for us.
Yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, it's a terrible thing.
But it would
thing,
be good for the climate.
But it would be good for, but already China, for example, is talking about matching any tariffs that the United States imposes. So, the orange goldfish decided he's going to put tariffs on $300 billion worth of incoming Chinese goods. And the Chinese say, okay, we're going to put a tariff on $300 billion worth of pork bellies from Iowa and corn and all that stuff that's leaving the United States. So now the poor farmers in the Midwest making soy, which the Chinese like, right, in their tofu, all of a sudden they don't have that market anymore. And the Chinese have – so if China, for example, wanted to somehow claim a carbon credit by preventing the export of highly carbon-intensive products. I guess I can't mean cement is one of them, right? There's a lot of carbon produced in making cement. There's certainly all the fossil fuels. I guess I don't have a great example of a particular item that you would put this kind of carbon tariff on, but it's an interesting concept. So.
Right. And I mean, you know, I also think it's curious that we have Russia and U.S. leaning so heavily on, you know, on the future of the oil industry when, and of course I'm biased, but I've read so much that says, you know, the future's not good for oil when you look at how it is. Yeah, and so to have us sort of leaning so heavily on that as our big deal, as our, you know, what's going to lead us is, seems really, really.
Well, and that leads to the to the, sort of, the final link in this this chain of spaghetti noodles I'm weaving here. But the but there was an article by Dave Roberts at Vox where he talked about the fact that natural gas, which has been billed as the bridge to the future, the bridge fuel to a future that a semi-clean energy source that would help us get through to the time when renewables were cheap and flourishing, right? That that natural gas would be that and would have a strong place in the energy economy for the next several decades, right? That was the idea. What's his name? Dave Roberts' argument is that the price of renewables, in particular solar and wind, and now the increasing capacity of battery storage, which is key, are basically making even existing, recently built natural gas power plants obsolete, and they become stranded assets that are not worth the money that it takes to run them. And his point is that this is happening so much faster than anyone thought that it's giving the utilities pause. And the argument is, the argument kind of goes like this, without getting into too much detail, but the natural gas power plants can be turned on and off relatively quickly, okay? So they and what happens is, but they're expensive to run. So what happens is that on those very hot or very cold days, let's say the very hot days like there are this week, right? Humidity's high, temperature's high, everyone wants to turn on their air conditioning. The demand for power is enormous in the New England area. It's at that point where electricity becomes very, very, very valuable, right? And so they have these power plants run by natural gas that are called peaker plants that only turn on when there's peak power demand, okay? And the companies can make a huge amount of money by being able to turn on, it's called dispatchable power. They can turn on this huge power plant and generate lots of electricity on a half-hour notice, right? Because they at 11:30, the guys who control the grid say, boy, by noon it's going to be really, really hot. We better get some more electricity out there. They go to these peaker plants. What's happened is that technology is developed so that batteries, enormous batteries, can hold enough electricity that you don't need the peaker plant anymore. So as the cost of batteries drops and that technology improves, all of a sudden you don't need that expensive gasoline, natural gas powered peaker plant. You've got this battery in the backyard. You're going to flip a switch and you dump that power out there. And so the combination of the dropping cost of the renewable energy, the wind and solar, plus the ability to store the power in the battery for use on demand when you need it at midnight or whenever, that really makes the it's beginning to make the construction of new gasoline, new natural gas plants uneconomic, which really and this is happening in the near term, not in 2040. It's happening now, and that's the kind of hopeful point that he was making. So there you go. I mean, there's a dark conspiracy driving the Globe op-ed page, which tells you that Trump and Putin have their dark conspiracy, which say, oh, yeah, we're going to fight the dark conspiracy by having a carbon-based tariff. And, oh, yeah, on top of it all, the natural gas plants are all going to become stranded assets. So that is my silly. So anyway, I just had to get that one off my chest. But tell me, Mariah, you're intrigued by yet another disaster approaching us over the next 15 years that has to do with my favorite pastime of being on the internet and reading Twitter. So tell me.
Well, so I was going to say, you know, do you rely on the internet? Do you use it?
I do. You know,
do you think it's important for anything? I don't know.
I think it's important for communicating climate information.
That's right. Well, and we talk a lot about on this program about the importance of mitigation, stopping climate change, so that we don't have to worry and spend a ton of money on adaptation. And I think it's very important to emphasize that. But in the meantime, you know, we are starting to have to think about adaptation. And there was I guess it was a report at a conference from a couple of some scientists led by Paul Barford out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison that basically said that there are all of these underground fiber optic cables that will be inundated with water as sea levels rises. And over 4,000 miles of these fiber optic cables will, if they become submerged, will be completely out of action much, much, much earlier than they thought originally. They thought, oh, maybe in 50 years we'll have to be concerned. And now they're saying, nope, actually in 15 years, the fiber optic cables in cities like New York, Seattle, and Miami could be completely out of commission.
I mean, these are the cables that sort of run up and down the East Coast, sort of the what they used to call a fat pipe, right, that sent all the internet traffic back. They run them basically along the edge of the country, and that's where the sea level rises, right?
Exactly. And so those underground cables may render some of those cities in trouble when their people are trying to check their email and do their economy, you know, get their economy going. And, you know, so all this talk about how climate action is going to cripple the economy is such nonsense, because you think of the ways that climate adaptation is going to cripple the economy, and they're so much bigger than
trying
to stop it before it happens.
I mean, can you imagine what you're saying is over the next 10 to 15 years, they're going to have to basically rebuild that entire internet infrastructure. And as you say, I mean, the internet is now fundamental to life, despite the fact that net neutrality is dead, right? The internet is important to everything, and you're going to have these horrific outages potentially because of sea level rise.
Right, in some of the major cities in the country, absolutely.
Amazing, amazing. Well, I think what I will do is do an extra couple runs through Facebook tonight, just so I get my fill before the wires die, before the fiber optics all get flooded out. Goodness. Well, thank you. Thanks for nothing, Mariah. I'll send you a snail mail letter saying thank you very much for alerting me about the death of the internet.
Get your fill of kitten and puppy videos before it's gone.
That's right. I'm gonna store them all on my computer. Anyway, we'll put up the links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find this show on our Facebook page as well. It's at /massclimateaction. You can click through to the show and the SoundCloud link. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, etc., etc. You can, of course, find us on Apple Podcasts. I realize I just said smartphone. Which
you are so Boston.
It's not a smartphone. Anyway, we'll close the way we always close by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the Trump administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. It's great to have you along. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.